Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in since they going back to showing Action Tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative, right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your host, Tom Mattis, and I welcome you back here to the Absolution Network. This is episode 110 of The Prerogative. Yes, 110 episodes in. And on this episode, we are going to review a show that I initially was going to record, or in fact, I did record and was going to review for episode 101, but things changed. I am, of course, talking about the Mega Smash internet sensation that you can see on Crunchyroll, brought to you by the same studios that brought you Red vs. Blue, done, brought to life by the wonderful, and brought from the mind, mind you, of the wonderful director and animator Monte of the Dead Fantasy series, among other spectacular fan-made internet series. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm, of course, talking about Ruby. Spelled R-W-B-Y. You know, this is a very interesting scenario. And, you know, I really, when you look at Red vs. Blue, when you look at Ruby, it's a reason Rooster Teeth, I think, has become, like, sort of the, you know, the leader for fan or amateur. I don't even call it amateur because they're kind of professionals now, but for small, independent, studio-made animation. And this is where, you know, CG being in its own way, cheaper with much more easier techniques to use than maybe a traditional hand drawn, comes in an advantage for smaller independent promotions. But definitely Monte became, I've talked about him before, has become an internet darling among anime fans, most certainly, in particular for his Dead Fantasy series, which that's about the only thing one of the few things I probably criticize about the series is, like, so how is this taken away from your Dead Fantasy series? Because I want to see the end of it. You can't do Tifa like you did her. Literally, that's, by the way, how good this director is. I want to point this out, that he's done this internet series, and unfortunately, I don't know if he'll ever finish it, but we're so invested in it that we want him to finish it. It was so invested in a storyline where there's really no dialogue. It's all about fighting. And yet there's this story that has came out of it. Literally, if you watch the entire Dead Fantasy series, there is no dialogue whatsoever. And there's this storyline that's came out of it. It's a great example of how action can denote story. Essentially, what he's done is he's done what wrestling has done for decades, which is, it's the art of fighting. It's the art of telling a story true fighting spirit and all of that jazz. You know, it's why wrestling has always been popular throughout the decades, and regardless of whether the elitists look down on it as wrestling, the fact of the matter is, Raw has pretty much, since it won the Monday Night Wars, has been on top of ratings ever since. In fact, I'm taking one of my current college classes I'm taking is in TV production, and we were recently looking at last week's ratings, which was Monday Night Raw's go-home show for the Royal Rumble. And even though you had the Pro Bowl there, which made number one, Monday Night Raw held three of the top five spots. Now, mind you, I add that the reason for that is because they actually break the shows up into hour chunks. So it broke up each hour of Raw into three individual chunks, and those three chunks held three of the top five spots. Top six spots, excuse me. Because of State of the Unions. So when you consider the fact that two of those six spots were State of the Union and the Pro Bowl, which were pretty significant events in their own mind. And I know I'm getting sort of off track into a different story. I promise I'm going to get back to Ruby in a second. You know, it's pretty popular. And that's what Monty Hume has done with his Dead Fantasy series and with his ability to tell a story through fighting. I like to call it through booking a fight. He's booking certain things to happen in a certain fight. You're getting invested, you see this great battle, and then here's who ultimately wins. You either agree or disagree, but you become so emotionally invested in it that if it is that twist, and who you... And you want to say which team is going to win. And I bring up fighting for a reason, because fighting is a huge part of the series. It's a huge part of what Monty Hume does really good. And the fact of the matter is, you know, it goes into something that, you know, in animation, in anime, and especially people who are fans of action, you know, it's kind of also why I go against the whole sexism notion, because really we don't care what the gender is as long as it looks cool. And that's something Monty Hume has done great. Regardless of whether the characters are ultra sexy or not, whether they're male or female, he does a great job showcasing and making characters look good through fighting, which is a big part of his series. And in fact, it's a big part of why a lot of people are watching. Because again, he became a darling with Dead Fantasy and his other internet videos. Haloid, I think, is the other one. The one where it's Samus versus Master Chief. And so, again, that goes into a big part of what makes this series popular. The other thing I think that's very unique about this series is that it's really a fusion of different CG animation styles. In the sense that it's created its own unique one, but really when you look at the animation, it's all of certain things, but there are two different techniques in play in creating the animation. There's the fighting there's a style used for the fighting scenes, and then there's the technique used for sort of non-fighting scenes to put in a way in the dialogue-driven scenes and that stuff. In the dialogue scenes, it's realistic CG. You know, because this is a CG title. And again, the answer, I think, unfortunately, with things like Shrek and that stuff, and just, you know, the amount of money that is put into CG movies that Pixar and DreamWorks does, we forget that a CG film can just be something that is a computer graphic animated film or series or whatever, which are done a lot more. A lot of TV series you see today, they are CG series. It's done completely on computer. And to me, that is not... I mean, there is something to be said for doing hand-drawn on computer, but there are a lot of series that to where they circle them, and again, they use certain techniques to do them, you know, on computer. And for me, this is more of the case of it is CG. They're designing characters, because and all designs start on paper, mind you. You gotta realize, regardless of what style of animation, whether it be stop motion, live action, traditional hand-drawn, or modern CG, it all starts on designs on paper. They didn't take those designs and whichever format they're going in, put it into that format. And, you know, either redraw it for traditional hand drawing, or in the case of CG, they put it into the computer and then they play with it. And again, these are all throughout this, these are models that they are playing with. But, you know, here they have models and they can walk a certain path and move their mouth. So it's realistic CG in a way. Again, realistic doesn't mean that it's photorealistic, but just realistic in that you can believe that these characters and that this world exists. Of course, for this type of CG, it's a bit more colorful and more cartoony. Again, it's the illusion of a different style. You know, again, if you remember my talk about the different styles, and really the three main styles of CG, you know, realistic, photorealistic, and what the other style here is that's used for the fighting, which is machinima, which that's what Red versus Blue is. Red versus Blue is firmly a machinima style. And for those who don't know, each of these individual styles are, they're about the illusion of reality and of the illusion of different style, of different techniques. You know, realistic, it's the illusion of cartoons and hand-drawn style. You know, that's what Frozen is, that's what Shrek is, that's what all of that is. And making you feel like this cartoony world is real. Photorealistic is as close to reality as we can get. It is CG in its purest form. And then machinima is really the sort of stop-motion live-action, or the illusion of stop-motion live, it's taking those stop-motion live-action techniques and bringing it into the CG world that you see with Red vs. Blue. And you see that here with the fighting, because again, that's what Dead Fantasy was. Dead Fantasy was a machinima. It took video game models, in this case, from Final Fantasy and Dead or Alive, and some other games, mind you, that are part of those connected to those franchises, and basically moved the models into fighting, choreographed fights. And again, this is what the fight animation and action animation is. So you have that balance there of the machinima technique with that realistic technique. Both sides firmly CG. You know, again, I'm going into semantics here about the animation style and its history and where it comes from this and behind it. And again, I think if when I talk about this subject, people get confused because I'm using it to bash CG. By no means am I bashing CG. You know, I've gone on my own tirades about the loss of traditional hand-drawn, but that's because I love all animation and I think there's room and there's the ability for everything to be done. I have a problem with the way, at least in this country, stockholders and certain people have taken a grasp over the entertainment industry and have decided, well, that's now too expensive. Not that it is. It costs the same amount of money, but because it takes a little bit maybe longer to do, which it doesn't, but that's besides the point. In their mind, it takes longer to do hand-drawn than it does CG. Therefore, it costs more. And again, I think if you, for anybody who's championed traditional hand-drawn, I think we've expended all the reasons that is complete bullshit. That's not to sit there and say that CG shouldn't exist. There is a place for CG films and CG series and the use of computer graphic animation. This is a great example. Again, I go back to the idea that what I want computer graphic animation to be is not a replacement for hand-drawn, but to be its own unique animation style to give animators an option of how to tell the story. Because that's what I ultimately want. I want animators to have an option. You know, and depending on what again, I'm bringing my TV production class to this. Depending on the defined project message they want to tell with their film or series, you know, depending on what that is, it really can, you know, they can then decide, well, which style of animation will help me best tell that story. You know, whether it be stop motion, whether it be traditional hand-drawn, or whether it be CG. You know, you look at things like Box Trolls and Coraline and Paranorman, which we've reviewed. All of these have its own unique style that helps lend itself to the story trying to be told. And they're very successful at that. Same thing with CG, as we saw with Book of Life. So, I kind of went on a tangent there, and I apologize. I just want to make sure that, because I do love this series. I know I'm giving away the review here. But at the same point in time, I want you to understand the history and everything behind it. Again, it goes into all the unique things, because this is the future of animation. It's not what the sole future should be, but it is part of the future. And this is stuff that I think independent and amateur animators are going to be using to get their name out there. And again, like I said, I apologize for going off on a tangent. But I'm Jewish, and that's what we do. We go off on tangents. And it's why we wandered in the desert for 40 years. Because we went off on tangents and then got lost and refused to ask for directions. But I digress. Enough of making fun of my people. So why don't we say we get into the review proper, shall we? So first, let me give you the synopsis for anybody who's not seen Ruby before. And again, spoiler alert, I will spoil something. If this is the first time ever seeing this, or listening to the show, I say, beware they be spoilers here. So, Ruby takes place in the world of Revenant, where supernatural forces known as Grimm are afoot. At academies, hunters and huntresses are trained to take care of these supernatural forces. One such academy is the academy known as Beacon, where four incredible young girls by the name of Westney, Blake Belladonna, Yang Zhao Long, and Ruby Rose are currently in training to become the best huntresses they can be, along with trying to uncover the recent plot in the Kingdom of Vale that seems to be trying to undermine the peace and tranquility of the kingdom. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Ruby.
They see you as small and helpless. They see you as just a child. Surprised when they find out that a warrior will soon run wild. Prepare for your greatest moments. Prepare for your finest hour. The dream that you've always dreamed is suddenly about to flower. We
We always start off with music, and we'll go music, animation, acting, and then story, of course, with a little bit of a break for I dare say commercial messages, but nobody's advertising on this show, so rather I advertise friends of mine. So there'll be a little break in between acting and animation for that, but we're going to go music, animation, acting, and then story. So let's start off with music, and we're going to just start off with, mind you again, this review. I didn't bring it up before, and so I apologize. When I initially was going to review the series as episode 101, I was just going to do the first season. But now that the second season has finished and everything, this is going to be a review of both the first and second season. So we had two intro themes to talk about. The first one, which I absolutely love. The title is "This Will Be the Day." This is, mind you, both are these great, awesome rock tracks that just get you into the. You just want to grab a sword and just start jumping into the world of Vale and just start chopping mother effers up. I mean, it really brings you. It gets you hyped for this. It's hyped up like. It's got all this energy in it. By the way, the music of the series is done by Jeff Williams, who did seasons like 1 through 8 for Red vs. Blue, and it features his daughter, Casey Lee Williams, doing the singing, on both, mind you. And again, it just has all this energy and it gets you hyped, you know. It has this sort of fairy tale sense. I mean, to mind you, to me, this is the ultimate, compliment for a good intro theme, when I think that the intro theme would work really well as a wrestler's intro theme. You know, to me, that's a big compliment. I don't know if other people think that, but like, I can imagine if I was a wrestler coming out to that, mind you, with a red cape on. But again, just the animation to go, it's just great, just flows perfectly with the energy of the song. But just again, just a great, you know, this would be the day. It's this great rock trap. Again, it has that, and mind you, of course, I'm also comparing this with the intro animation that it goes along with. It has this very Red Riding Hood feel to it that, again, I think that initially did catch, again, that whole fairy tale feel to the song, with the animation. But just again, like I said, it's just this great rock track. I don't want to call it metal, but it's got bits of metal in there. I didn't want to say pop rock, because I kind of compare it in a way to Evanescence, in the fact that you have that rock, the good rock band, and then you have the angelic voice as the lead singer. So I think that's the best comparison I can make. Maybe not as good as Evanescence, but certainly wonderful in its own unique way. And then, of course, you have the second intro theme, which is Time to Say Goodbye. And it, you know what? I think it's a great compliment to the first intro theme. The first intro theme had its own bit of hope to it. And again, and sort of connected with the themes of hope that were in the first season. And then the second season, there's a lot of questions. You know, I don't want to say it's the sophomore year, but it's the second season. And, you know, again, it's building. There's a lot more suspense in it. And there's a lot more questions in it. And again, you get that theme, particularly in the title of the song and in the song itself. You know, there's a point in the song where it says, it asks, basically, you know, are we heroes or are we basically pawns? To put it in layman's term, though it puts it in a different way other than pawns. I can't recall the lyrics off the top of my head right now. But again, it's this great rock track that mix up the melody of just a... not just a bit. I mean, it's a completely different melody, but there's some connection, some tonal connection, definitely with the first song that I really like. But like you said, again, it's a great rock track that has this great energy and definitely fits well with the season as well. Now, this does have ending themes to it, but the ending theme, you know, it has all these different ending themes, and if I went down the endings for each episode, because literally, you know, ending one is Ruby Rose, ending two is Shining Beacon, part one, endings... EP2 is Shining Beacon Part 2. Or I believe that these are the endings. Each, you know, there's an ending score for each episode. And they're all pretty good. They're all unique. Some better than others. But this was definitely serious, unfortunately, to where, you know, when the ending hit, I was more excited to get to the next episode. It's part of... That actually leads to a downfall of how long these episodes are, and that's something we'll go more into when we get to story. But that being said, the score itself, really well done. Does a great job of establishing certain moods and establishing presence, which the music should. Not as good as maybe our last review series, which was Oh My Goddess. by any means, but you know, again, it's just in the same line as what it did with Red versus Blue. You know, and there's some good songs, and then there's songs that you really don't remember out of there, and so on and so on. But it's there, and it does a good job of setting mood in particular scenes. And, you know, they're pretty basic. You know, it's also a comedy scene, so we're going to have comedy music. It's a soundtrack that's definitely lead, or I should say led, by its intro theme. And, you know, again, you have the couple of good ending themes, and you have the couple of good scores. I think if you love this series, it's definitely a series you'd, or should say a soundtrack you would pick up. But other than that, you know, it is what it is. It pretty basic, I think, is what it is. And that's not a bad thing. Basic can sometimes be a good thing. And considering how much had to be put into this series, again, being from independent, it's basic good. So, I'm making it sound like a D&D character. with that, let's move on to animation. Again, the CG animation style, which we've kind of gone over, CG cel-shaded, very much influenced by anime, is the main semblance here. I think anybody can see. And again, that's not because of the big eye. Everybody makes the assumption that, oh, Big Eyes is influenced by anime. Well, Big Eyes may be used a lot in anime, but if you really want to talk about the influence of Big Eyes, you have to understand that the Japanese got the Big Eyes from us. Because we use the same exact... In fact, like when I see Ruby Roses and all their eyes, I'm actually very much immediately reminded of Betty Boop. In its own unique way. So again, you have to understand that came from us first. But no, the anime influence is the thin lines, and again, the stylized nature, or stylized almost, I was going to say stylized drawn nature. But I think the better term is the way it gives the illusion of that stylized drawn nature. Again, because of the stylized drawn designs as well. The use of color denotes anime style as well. I mean, it's very much that they are influenced by anime. And I thought they did a great job of that illusion of the anime style. Because again, when you're doing a realistic CG production, it's about the illusion, like I said, of the hand-drawn style. And it depends on which one you're going to. You know, when you watch Kung Fu Panda and Shrek and all those DreamWorks shows, which are, you know, Ice Age, you know, look at Book of Life even, you know, all those are influenced by the necessary cartoon style that it's being influenced by. You know, even hell, you'll even can say that, you know, Book of Life is influenced in a certain way by stop motion. But again, in a different, doing it in a different way than Machinima does it. So again, it's about that illusion of that style, that influential illusion, mind you. And here, the influential illusion is anime. And it's done very, very well. I know there are people, because I've talked with them, about saying, well, I consider it an anime. And I think there are people who might hear this and say, well, you're being disrespectful by not calling it an anime. Well, I'm not. It's its own thing. And I think actually calling it an anime is an attempt to say, well, they owe their... It's trying to denote that, well, their influence came from anime. Nobody's denying their influence came from anime. But again, it's its own unique style. And again, it has to be its own style. It's not done out of disrespect, it's actually done out of respect. I want to acknowledge the uniqueness of this style that is influenced by anime. And it's very obvious, I think, that anybody can see. Again, and that influence of anime comes with more of how the camera shots are set and how the scenes are set up. Design-wise, it's the line work. It's a lot more than just the color of the hair and the big eyes. But definitely the use of color. Forget anime influence. It's definitely Asian influence. That's another thing I think sometimes we forget, is that the use of color that we see in anime, that's really a very big Asian thing, because you see that in live-action film, both Japanese, Chinese, Korean films that are made in the Philippines, even in India. Color plays a big part in Asian cinema. I think we forget about that. It's not just in anime, it's an Asian thematic thing. And you definitely see that influence here. The character designs, you know what? I love each one. Each one is made unique in its own way. And again, the personalities that are paired up with them, I think, work very well. Ruby Rose, the black and red color scheme, I think works very well for her. Again, you know, right off the bat, you don't need to like search up the fairy tale thematic influence of her. She's based off Little Red Riding Hood. You see that right off the bat. And again, that she's little, and of course, the Red Riding Hood. I mean, all that's very obvious, but again, they work very well with that design, and it's just a very awe-inspiring, a very beautiful design to look at, and you enjoy looking at it because they play around with the rose petals that like go off when she dashes somewhere. So overall, just the overall design, and I think the best part is that there's like a little rose design on I want to call it a belt, but it's like towards like her hip area, but there's this little rose, and I think it's this little off-balancing thing that does a great job of gives it something unique. That it's not just black and red. There's some design work there that's very nice to look at and gives a lot of uniqueness to her character design. The black hair, the short black hair, I think it's a great design because it's very different from what usual heroes will have. And then you have Yang, again, the blonde hair with a lot of volume. I want to call it a very American design. And not in the fact that it's based off American animation, but in the fact that, again, it's based off, as I like to call it, sort of the more anime idea of what an American is. Again, she's very Texas in her own way. You know, she's... Okay, I'm going to go with chest here. But they show off a fair amount of her cleavage. And, you know, the big fluffy blonde hair. The fact that she's really the strong person of the group. All of that is very traditionally, you know, attributes of an American in anime form as done by Japan. You know, because again, that whole the cowboy, Texan... You know, really when you see Americans portrayed in Japanese anime traditionally, and particularly in comedies, they really come from either one of three places. Either it's the Hollywood American, it's the Texan American, or it's the New Yorker American. Or dare you say the Metro American. the City Boy American. Anyways. And there are, of course, some... not assumptions, but exceptions to the rule. One comes to mind, the Hero Man, as an exception. But then again, you had Stan Lee a part of that, who apparently forgets he ever worked on it. That does hurt. It really does. And it somewhere, my good friend Spidey Dude is like, he's this old! He's allowed to forget! Hi, Spidey Dude. But anyways, I do like her design in comparison to what her character is. So I think it worked very well. And again, the color schemes, the brown with the yellow. Again, kind of doing that sort of cowboy style, which fits with her personality as well. And again, the fact that she's a puncher. And she has these gun-punching things, which... The weapon... We'll get into weapons in a second, because I think we have to get into that after we go over the characters. Blake Belladonna, again, the use of black, very well done, and I think I'm going to start going through these, because for the most part, all the character designs are really, really well done. I love the use of black as really the main color. I'm the black and the gray for Belladonna, I think, fits with her character personality well. Again, the moody type. Again, you know, the difference between the black with Ruby Rose is, again, the red and the black created contrast. It's sort of, you know, give you a certain sense, but Ruby Rose is an exception because she's all about, you know, what you see isn't necessarily what you get, and that's a big part of her character. With Snee, again, her character off Snow White being white, and then her and Blake create a great color contrast. And then you add the red and the yellow of Yang and Ruby Rose, and you add them all together, and it's this very good color contrast. Black and white, red and yellow, too dark and too bright colors as a team. As you get on the list of characters, I'm just going to try to go through this as quickly as possible. Joan Arc, I thought I really like his color scheme, his overall design, in particular to his character's influence, which is Joan of Arc, and the fact that, you know, suit of armor, a lot of neutral colors, grays, denim. I think that works very well. Nora Valkyrie, a lot of pink. I think that works well. Nikos, with the sort of light, the fire sort of color scheme of red and yellow, I think worked very well. You know, Lin Rain, again, with the green. And then you compare that team together. It seems like a crayon box, but that works together for that team dynamic as well. You know, overall, I really enjoy all the character designs. I think a lot of them were very well done. Cinder's Falls, Torchwick, I think do a great job. Are very good character designs for the antagonists. One thing I like about Cinder Falls is, again, how her character design is a direct comparison to Ruby Rose's. Again, they really use the same color scheme, the black and the red, but there's a little bit of white thrown in there. It's very minuscule for Cinder Falls, and I think that works very well for the compare and contrast. And then how they're used and how the colors contrast with each other in different designs denotes villain and hero, and I love that contrast there. I think it was very smartly designed in that sense. And then, of course, mind you, in talking about that, you have the weapons. And I thought the weapon designs are great. I love the weapons in this. You know, Ruby Rhodes' scythe and how it transforms into a gun. It's part of the uniqueness, definitely, of the series is the weaponry and the technical aspect of, and some of it can't possibly exist, but just like, I mean, in particular, when you get, I have to try to find her. There's a particular character. She's basically this, like, stylistic girl. I don't know how to put it. I'm trying to find her right now. Coco is her name. She's a description here is a fastly dressed girl with accessories. She has a belt line. Think like a military version of a fashion model, in a way. The fact is, she has this small handbag, and then it transforms into a goddamn minigun. What is wrong with this man? I'm like, that ain't right. There's so much wrong here. Wrong in a good way, but wrong here. Because that ain't right. I need to get me that. Okay, where can I find these handbags? Because I want one. But yeah, it's just like Ruby Rose with the scythe. And again, that's just with the hood and everything. It almost gives her a Grim Reaper look. I mean, when you add the weapon into it. Yang with the gaffs. As I'm trying to look up what she used. But there's basically these gauntlets. that she uses that also shoot bullets, basically. And then you have Snee. Snee is a rapier. Okay, right here. Shotgun gauntlets. I guess that's synonymous. Belik Baldana has a katana. It also has a pistol part of it. So you have that part. You know, Joan of Arc, the shield that can shrink down. You have Nora, who has a hammer that converts into a grenade launcher. God damn it. That's so wrong. Perona has the rifle, Javelin. And it's another weapon here that I can't look up. It's a Greek weapon that's a double-edged, one-handed, Iron Age straight sword. So it's answers to three things, and then you have Lin Ren, dual pit machine pistols with attached blades. I'm going over the weapon because all the weapon designs are great, and it's like, oh my god, what does this weapon... Okay, it's a sword, but I know this sword is going to transform into something different. You know, my favorite, though, by far... I mean, mind you, I brought up Coco, and the handbag that transforms into a goddamn minigun. But my favorite is Sun Wukong's, who's a character gets introduced towards the end of the first season. He wields a collapsible bow that splits into two nunchucks that are shot, where the nunchucks are sawed-off shotguns. Thank you and good night. I'm done. I want. This is part of the thing that really... This is a great example of a series, I think, using what it has to its advantage to connect up with multiple audiences. Because you have the story and sort of girl power here that definitely connects with the female audience. And this is kind of getting the story. But here in animation, you have... technical weaponry and a technical machinery and all these things, things transforming, that definitely connects with a male audience as well. So, very smartly planned, but at the same point, it's also executed as well, which is why it needs to be praised. These aren't things that are... And that's not to sit there and say that females aren't wowed by technical aspect and males aren't wowed by story, but... for the most part, what's going to bring them in initially is that stuff. And then they can love the other things. You know, it's part of what made Gundam Wing successful. Men were brought in because you had giant freaking mech suits that shot, that had scythes and Gatling guns and everything. And then they stayed for the story. Whereas you had girls who came in for the story and then fell in love with the mech suits. So, it's about what brings people in, and then, of course, they can stay for other things. But then again, if they're just there for that, that's also good as well. Overall, as long as they're enjoying the series, why do you knock it? Before we get into action, because when we get into action animation, we're going to be here for a bit. And, I'm already closing in, like, the 45-minute mark. So... without a break, mind you. So, or at least as by recording, this is before editing to break that fourth wall there, folks. Let's just go over background and special effects really quick. I think that's done extremely well. The special effects are very simple. But again, they don't have a huge budget for this series, mind you. So there's definitely some things, you know, background people for that matter... they do their best to make the cities, you know, seem like they're very well populated, but there's only so much they can do. And that sort of hurts the series a bit. It depends on where you're, I think, where the audience is coming from. When you're an audience member like me, I can forgive some things because at least they're trying. You could tell there's only so much they can do with the technology they have as an independent studio. At the same point in time, for a larger mass audience, that's going to hurt them in that standpoint. But I still think they do a decent enough job, but I think they could also put a lot more people in there. And you know, I mean, there are times where they're in set locations. I think of this point in season 2 where Penny, which is a character who's influenced by Pinocchio, was this robot that's been designed, this basically androidian robot that looks like a real girl, but she isn't. Again, the whole Pinocchio thing here. And Ruby, that helped them at the end of the first season. And while investigating something in the first 4 episodes, or investigating the White Fang, Ruby Rose finds her. Anyways, make long story short, there's a point to where they're in this alleyway, and the alleyway is its 2 gray walls and a dumpster. And it's very plain, and it's just, there could be a little bit more detail there. You could have had maybe a CG mouse and some graffiti. We ran out of time, is what that feels like. And it's not so much sloppy, you know. Again, the story and other animation is strong enough to carry it, but definitely the backgrounds are weak points. I mean, there are backgrounds that are spectacular, and they're done in their own unique animation style. I mean, when you look at Beacon and the forests and the abandoned city at the end of season 2 and other things like that, definitely. They have enough detail there, and it looks wonderful. But there's some slower scenes, and there are some spots that aren't as spectacular. And just very plain in some form. But at the same point in time, it's not something that I feel completely hurts the series. It's just a matter of, it comes off as a matter of time, and what they had to work with technology-wise. That being said, last thing on animation is action animation. And again, I left it last for a reason, because I didn't think I'd be going into character design that much. But, let's go into action animation. God damn. Like I said, this is the strength of the series. It's what I think a lot of people definitely tuned into this series, because when we first heard inklings of this series was done by Monty Um, oh, who's Monty Um? Oh, he did the Dead Fantasy. Oh, I know that guy. Or they then searched him on the internet and saw Dead Fantasy and like, wow, these scenes were really awesome. I wonder what type of fight scenes are going, because I think everybody, and especially once they saw the trailer and saw the fights in the trailer, it's like we really got excited for the fights. And god damn it. One thing I like is that they just don't fill every episode with fights. They build up to their fights. And they do it in arcs. And particularly in the second season, where you have a build-up to it. To where, well, there's 4 episodes. And in episode 4, there's a really big fight scene. And they do kind of have one, they have a playoff that in the second season on the first episode to set up things. And then they have one in the 4th episode. And then it's really a lot of talking until for the next 4 episode arc. And then they slowly build towards more fighting, and they show some fighting Grimm in the 3rd to last. There's more fighting in the 2nd to last. And then the whole, for the most part, the main premise of the last episode is them fighting off the Grimm that infiltrated the city. And different teams coming off and basically showing off i.e. Coco and her mini bag, mini gun combo. It's, I like, really? Really? Okay. Good night, everybody. I'm just thinking about that mini bag, mini gun. It's like there's so much wrong with this in so many ways. And in good ways, too. It's just unfair. I want that headbag. I can't stop thinking about it. But I love how they build up the action. They do it also in season 1 in the first episode. And then, I mean, there's a lot more action oriented, because again, it's them, in particular the first half of season 1, to where they're trying to prove themselves with the tests and everything. And then Then they build up to the actually the finale of the second season, and when they're on the pier and everything. And there's just so many good fights to talk because they're all good. And again, that's the thing is I wouldn't be talking about the build-up so much if it wasn't worth the wait. And it's worth the wait. They're excellent fight scenes. You know, the fight scene and see the whole sequence of the fight scene to where it starts, you know, them running away from Torquay, who's in the giant robot, which leads to the chase on the highway, which is done extremely well, which leads to Team Ruby facing off with him and, you know, all in like in between the highways deep down underneath, you know, they like fall to the below the highway and they're fighting there. Great fight scene there. The fight scenes when in season one where they're proving themselves in the Emerald, I think it's the Emerald Forest or Twilight Forest. I'd have to look it up. Yeah, the Emerald Forest. That's done extremely well. Like I said, the fight on the pier, especially for Sun Wukong, who again, the whole nunchuck shotguns are just like, well, like, wait a minute. They're not just nunchucks, they're guns as well, and he's shooting them off. It's like, I haven't loved the weapon this much since the Gunblade. I mean, that's the type of weaponry we're, by the way, talking about here. so that was definitely worth it. The train sequence was done extremely well, and again, showed off each character. And of course, like I said, the final fight in that final episode. Just, again, and the fights have always gotten better and better with each as the series has gone along. It's not so much that it's one up itself, it's that it's improved on something. And they've shown something different. It never feels like they're rehashing things. And mind you, the fight scenes also do a great job of showing the strength of each character who is fighting, which I love. Definitely, it's the biggest strength of the animation in this series is the action, because that's what everything is leading up to. That's what everybody's anticipating. And when you get that episode where it's like, hey, we've done the build-up, we've told the story to get to this action scene, here's the action scene, and you see the action scene, it's like, okay, it's well worth the wait. Just like when that eventual next episode of Dead Fantasy finally drops, that will be well worth the wait. But yeah, bar none, best part of the animation is the action. It just is amazing. The characters are made to look strong. Again, this goes back to that whole booking idea. You know, how this is like, right, it's the art of fighting. Again, you even if they don't completely succeed in every objective and have captured all the bad guys, and even when they lose, they're still made to look strong. You know, it's like, this a little mistake here or there cost them the victory, or, you know, help them get the guy, or, you know, again, characters are made to look strong, and the villains are made to look like weak, who take advantage of opportunities given to them. And again, that's just class, that's wrestling booking 101. Your villains need to cheat to win. And certainly they do. You know, whether it be a new character who they don't know the abilities, who gets them out of trouble, you know, even when they're captured, you know, they're eventually going to be broken out, and it's that, you know, they're going to do it in a slimy way. It's booking 101. I understand people might not understand the connection I make to wrestling here. But again, it really is. And you're okay, here's the fight. Here's the story told in the fight. You know, you make these characters look strong, and you make them look like they can win, but you also give an opening for the villains to escape or do something so that the story can continue and they have to fight another day. It's wrestling booking 101. But it is. It's, you know, how they're having a feud. How do you extend that feud? And they do a great job with it. So the action animation is just superb and is really the best part of this series, bar none. So I have now been talking for 55 minutes. Or at least that's so much recording. If you break down the fact that it took me 15 minutes for the opening, yeah, that breaks it down to 40 minutes. So I'm going to take a break. I'm going to get something to drink. And while we're on break, I'm going to play some promos for some people and some friends of mine who do other podcasts who you need to check out. including one crisis that you have to check out. So I'll play some promos for you guys, and when we come back, we can get to acting and the story. So I'll be right back, folks.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Superman,
Captain Marvel,
Batman.
It is 1985.
Robin of Earth 2.
Sergeant Rock.
The Legion of Superheroes.
This is the most eagerly awaited comic book event in 50 years.
Tommy Tomorrow.
Jonah Hex.
Commandy.
It will one day be called the greatest comic book event of all time.
Swamp Thing.
Wonder Woman.
The New Teen Titans.
The Haunted Tank.
Infinity Incorporated.
Worlds will live.
Green Arrow.
Worlds will die.
Supergirl.
The Flash.
And that is only the beginning.
The Justice League of America.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Huntress.
Ariana.
The Metal Man.
Firestorm. The Nuclear
Man. Outsiders.
Green Lantern.
The Blue Beetle.
The Crime Syndicate.
Warlord.
The Guardians of the Universe.
Tales of the Justice Society of America proudly presents,
and many, many more,
Crisis on Infinite Earths. The DC Universe will never be the same.
Coming January only at twotruefreaks.com.
Greetings, podcast listener. Do you like...
Gotcha, Mom!
Or maybe...
Dragon Flame!
How about...
Tatsuo! Ganido!
Or...
In the year 1999, an abandoned alien battle fortress crash-landed on the planet Earth. Our most brilliant scientist and engineer spent the next 10 years reconstructing the damaged ship and studying its highly advanced space technology called Robotech.
Do you remember...
Our Star Blazers!
Or this?
The year is after Colony 195. As the world constantly changes in the chaotic era, there are two mobile suits that could turn humans into the ultimate weapon. The Wing Zero, and the Epion.
Or maybe even this.
After the desire for blood rules all, the only hope left is the one they call D.
Or this.
Team, grappler ships dead ahead!
It wouldn't be fun otherwise! Let's do it!
Or...
If Cardis is allowed to be reborn, she'll destroy Marmo as well as Lodos!
Or have you seen the latest episode of...
And just like that, everything changed. At that terrible moment, in our hearts, we knew home was a pen, humanity, cattle.
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then you should check out Anime Freaks, hosted by Dr. Bill Robinson and me, Gene Hendricks. Anime Freaks is a monthly podcast covering all things anime. It is available at twotruefreaks.com. and on iTunes under Two True Freaks Presents Anime Freaks.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
Imagine the world you have known all your life suddenly begins to change.
The changes are almost imperceptible at first, but soon everything comes crashing around you.
Past and present contradict each other. History is no longer immutable.
Inconsistencies begin to pop up. New origins rendered stories only a few years old null and void.
Those long gone are no longer dead.
Worst of all, your friends and loved ones are vanishing or changing.
The very fabric of reality surrounding the DC universe is unraveling.
In Smallville, Jor-El and Lara have returned to take Superman back to an unexploded Krypton.
In Metropolis, Superman is faced with a multitude of Batmen.
The time stream, made fragile by countless twists and myriad travelers, is now spinning out of control. Time is running out. Quickly.
Only the greatest heroes of every era and reality can stop this crisis in time.
And stop it they must, or the DC Universe will cease to exist, perhaps never to have existed at all.
The heroes and villains of the DC Universe are facing their
Zero Hour.
In 1994, DC published Zero Hour, Crisis in Time, a five-issue miniseries designed to fix some of the continuity issues that had cropped up since the conclusion of the Crisis on Infinite Earths.
This was a huge deal, and because of that, and because Superman played such a large part in that story, From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast hosted by Jeffrey Taylor
and Michael Bailey
will be covering the Superman issues, as well as Zero Hour itself.
We will also be looking at all of the official crossovers to the series, in addition to devoting several episodes to the follow-up event, Zero Month, where Superman meets a brand new enemy.
Conduit.
Zero Hour.
Zero Month.
Only at From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast. From Crisis to Crisis can be found at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com, and is part of the Superman Podcast Network, which is located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
Also be sure to check out the Fortress of Baileytude, which is located at www.fortressofbaileytude.com. There you will find new episodes of From Crisis to Crisis, as well as all kinds of fun bits of business connected to Zero Hour and Zero Month.
And welcome back, and let's get right into it with acting, which means it's time to go over our cast list. So we have Lindsay Jones as Ruby Rose. We have Kara Burley as Yang Xiaolong. Erin Zek as Wes Snee. Barbara Dunkelman as Blake Belladonna. Miles Luna as Jean Arc. Jen Brown as Pariah Nikos. Monty Oom himself voices Len Reen, which begs the question, why would he put his character in such a compromising position as he does in Season 2? Again, I guess fan service for the ladies. That's all I'll say about that. Samantha Ireland as Nora Valkyrie. Shannon McCormick as Professor Ospin. Kathleen Zulek as Glinda Goodwitch. Gary G. Haddock as Roman Tortwick. J.J. Castillo as Mercury Black. Katie Newville as Emerald Sustria. And Walter said, "What did you say?" And of course, Jessica Nigria as Cindy Falls, or Cinda Falls. Though, maybe Cindy Falls would... Cinder Falls also works as well. I was about to say Cindy Fall maybe more of a direct correlation to Cinderella, but Cinder Falls does it as well. For those who know the original fairy tale... I think it's obvious by now that there's a huge fairy tale play. And we'll get into that in story. Overall, I thought everybody did a good job. Voice acting isn't the strength of this series by any means. It's all definitely the action. But again, they do a really good job, all of them do. Nobody blows me away, but nobody's just average. There's definitely passion from the crew here, and they all do a good job. And I mean, there's some voice actors I think do a better job. I mean, to me, the standout voice actor in this entire series is Gray G. Haddock as Roman Tortwick. Because, again, just really stands out. Then followed by Lindsay Jones as Ruby Rose. Again, I think that does help the series work as well. You know, and I think Jones, Burley, Zex, and Dunkelman, whether they're all recording together or not, they have the ability to have this great connection between, and there's this great chemistry between their characters that works very well. Jen Brown and Miles Luna also have a great connection that makes those characters work as well. I mean, overall, the voice cast has done very well. Maybe I don't know anything. I thought Jessica Nigro did a great job. I mean, she was brought in, obviously, to be sultry. Because Cinder Falls' character is a very sultry character. A very sultry villain, mind you. Obviously, she did a good enough job because she's just been hired... very recently by Sentai Filmworks to voice Sonico in the Super Sonico animation that I guess they licensed for the English dub. For those who don't know who Super Sonico is, Super Sonico was a mascot character that was created in 2006 for the Nitro Plus Music Festival that became very popular. And I think she's as far as an anime mascot, is right up there with Vocaloid. And, you know, she's well known for her headphones that she's always wearing, and for her prodigious chest that, let's put it this way, if there is a Hooters University, she'd probably go there on scholarship. I've waited an hour to do that goddamn joke. That is sad on so many levels. But back to voice acting, I think they all did a really good job. They're not blow-away performances by any means, but they're really good, and more importantly, there's passion, and again, they do a great job of telling the story in their voices. I think what I'm trying to get to is, this isn't a... I can see other people doing this and doing just as well. It's not like, oh, I see Lindsay Jones as Ruby Rose and nobody else. They are brought in to play certain characters, and they play those characters well. But I just think that for a lot of them, maybe Lindsay Jones isn't the best example. But I think for a large part of the cast, you could bring other people into the role, and it can be just as good and just as acceptable. I think a large part of the cast doesn't... They do it very well, but they don't make the role their own. You know? Lindsay Jones does that a bit more than the rest of the cast. The reason why I brought up Gary G. Haddock as Roman Tortwick is because he is the one who really makes that role his own. And really jumps into that role. And that's the one role where, okay, I can't see anybody but Gray... doing that role. I mean, Jessica Nigro does a good job and obviously got her... I don't know technically if this got her that role, but obviously she's a good enough voice actor where she can actually do a professional dub job as she's gained work with Sentai Filmworks. But at the same point in time, She plays a very sultry character. She does it well, but she doesn't really make the role her own. You know, Kara Edley and Zek, again, they play their characters very well, and certainly they could get somebody else who could do those sort of tonal points and go for that type of tone range. But at the same point in time, there's nothing absolutely special that they put into their voice that, to me, makes the role their own. Again, that's not a bad thing. It's, there are lines that, you know, again, let me use an example. I know it's unfair to use Scott McNeil, but I'll use Scott McNeil as an example. The reason Scott McNeil is so memorized and all his roles are memorized is because he adds something to those roles, to whether it be Waspinator, Dinobot, Rat Trap, in Beast Wars, whether it be Duo Maxwell in Gundam Wing, whether it be Koga in Inuyasha, regardless of what character he's doing, even if they have the same voice as another character he's done, it's to the point to where he adds something to that role that makes it unique, and he makes that role his own. I'll use another example. Tony Jaa in Disney's The Hunchback of Notre Dame. He does something special and makes that role his own. And he owns that role. Again, these are... I don't want to call them amateur, because I think if I call them amateur, my good friend here on the Absolution Network, John Ramos, will get mad at me, because I think they're voice actors that are like on the level. I mean, John could probably speak more to this, and maybe I need to bring John on to talk about this more. Because I don't know, I don't want to say I don't know if I'm completely right. I know what I'm trying to say, and I don't know if I'm saying it successfully is what I think I'm saying. But I think overall my criticism here is, while they're good, and in fact they're great throughout the roles, they're just missing that one essential thing most of them are, with the exception of a couple, that makes the role their own. So it's not so much a criticism. I'm just trying to differentiate between how good they are. They're good. They're, in fact, really good. They're just not great. Because, again, that one little thing. I think I really need to bring John on to talk about this. John, if you're listening, I got to bring you on because I need to talk about this. So I think last but not least, it's time to talk about story. And the first thing we'll talk about is the main plot. And again, for the most part, everything seems to delve into fantasy and fairy tales in thematic ways. The fairy tale thematic mostly deals itself with naming and character personality and the play off of that and how they work well together. Fairy tales, you know, you have Ruby Rose, while also a play off Snow White, but mainly a play off Little Red Riding Hood, Zhang Zhao Nao Long, excuse me. it's you can tell it's been a long night and I'm getting tired, so I apologize, folks. But, you know, again, the illusion to Goldilocks there. That's where also her strength comes in again. It's sort of the strength of, like, a bear, and so, no, again, that's the illusion to Goldilocks as well. Blake, Belladonna, also, you know, Blake's allusion to Belle in Beauty and the Beast, as Blake is also an old term for black as well, again, to her color. Wes is an allusion to Snow White, as the translation of her German name is White Snow. Again, she also uses ice a lot. Going into some other characters, you know, Nora Valkyrie, her last name is allusion to the female warriors of Norse mythology. Joan Arc is of Joan of Arc. Nikos is derived from the goddess Nike. And also Achilles from Homer's Iliad. And you see this throughout the series, so again, that thematic play. But there's also the fairy tale and fantasy aspect of, you know, the Grimm. You know, the supernatural force is known as the Grimm. Again, another fairy tale aspect. Again, let's be honest, fairy tales have been very popular recently. You know, Once Upon a Time, Grimm. What's the other show? I think there's one other show, Sleepy Hollow. But there's one other show. For what reason, I think there's one other show. I don't know. But the plot, very simple. There's the plot and then there's a subplot that influences the main plot. The main plot is, you know, again, them trying to become huntresses. And then you have the individual character plots that lead into it and influence it. That's done extremely well. You know, Blake trying to, you know, basically she is a faunus. The world of Remnant, and I didn't kind of go into it in the synopsis, but there's humans and there's beings known as faunus. They're basically humans with animal traits who are discriminated against because they, you know, humans think they're like one step away from being grim, and they don't trust them for that reason, and they've been discriminated against. And, you know, there's this group called the White Fang that was initially peaceful, and now they're not. In fact, I find it funny they're called the White Fang, and I wonder why nobody has gotten it in its own way. It's a Gundam Wing reference. Again, you had the group, the White Fang, that was a spin-off, that was a terrorist organization spinoff of, you know, the peaceful groups that spun out of Hiro Yui that then became terrorists in Gundam Wing. I really wonder why nobody has gotten that. I'm gonna have to ask, if I ever interview Monty Oom, I'm gonna have to ask him about that, if the naming of them as the White Fang ever came up from being influenced by Gundam Wing, because that I wouldn't be surprised, mind you. But there's all that whole storyline going with Blake's, you know, Snee trying to, you know, her family has been doing some underhanded dealing, she wants to stop that. Yang and Ruby wanting, of course, to find stuff about their parents and, you know, being influenced by them being hunters and huntresses and deciding to become that as well. And then there's all these subplots. And, of course, you have the subplot with Cinder Falls and her workings with Torquit and the White Fang and how that's all. And there's little twists and turns here and they're all done wonderfully. Overall, the story is very easy to follow. And it all plays off itself wonderfully. It's very engaging. Part of that is also the character development, which is a really big part of the focus in these stories. You know, they give you a little story on what's here and there, the main story and the main things, in particular the mystery part of Torquit and Cinder Falls and that stuff. But a big part of it is also, again, the relationship between the teammates. And how they work as a team, because ultimately it's that those relationships and their good terms with each other that help them win the day. Again, you know, friendship will win the day. And so that's a big part. And again, and so it's a very character-focused, character storyline-heavy storyline overall. And they do it extremely well, even though they don't have a lot of time. That's something to go over, as we'll go over now. You know, that was more what hurt Season 1. You know, Season 1 would have some very short episodes. Season 2, I think, kind of rectified that, as they were more over 10 minutes. They would be at least 15 minutes, most of them, or at least around that range, you know, around the 12 to 15 minute range, as opposed to episode, or should I say Season 1, to where you would have it somewhere in between, you know, the 8 to 10 minute range for episodes. Of course, you also had a lot more episodes in that standpoint. I think, if I'm right, you had like 16. But yeah, but they definitely got a little bit more longer in Season 2. I think ultimately that's what makes Season 2 a bit better than Season 1, is that it has a better pace to it, because the episodes are more steady and more longer, and you can tell more story in that time frame. And again, it allows you to have some action scenes along with doing character development and other things. So that definitely works. Part of also what makes the character interactions with each other work very well. Again, it's you. This is the Rooster Teeth crew, and they have their own unique style, ornate understanding, mind you, of comedy that works very well. If you watch Red vs. Blue, in its own way, it's that sort of same comedy stylings. Not as sort of male-dominated about dick jokes and things like that as Red vs. Blue is. There's definitely more of attention to it almost being so almost soap opera-y in its own way. There's a lot of anime-inspired fused jokes and things like that, and cutesy jokes. And okay, one that comes to mind is later in season two, Ruby and Yang get a package. Like, please take care of him. There's no way. Take care of him. Shake the pack. Out pops a dog that's obviously a reference to Ayn from Cowboy Bebop, as it's the same type. And each character's away. You know, Blake being a cat person jumps on the bed. Like, what's that thing Dean here? It's like, and she's on her top bunk, and Ayn's like, I want to bark at you. Of course, she's like, we're not laying this. You know, Weiss is going, we're not laying this wrangly, muddy, like, and aren't you the cutest little thing? Oh, yes, yes, you are. We're going to have so much fun. Yes, we are. It's like, good night, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to turn in. Thank you. Not every joke, mind you, works very well. I mean, the joke with Joan eventually putting on a dress works very well. It's the dancing scene that, I understand that probably a lot of people like that whole dead fantasy dancing stuff that he did. It didn't need to be here. I mean, mind you, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but how the hell are they dancing in those clothes like that? It's like, it all of a sudden turns into a music video. It's like, and we broke the fourth wall. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and goodbye. I think that's maybe the one sort of joke. I think it was meant to be a joke, but it didn't work. But most of the jokes in this series work very well. They add the comedy that's needed for the scenes go on. And again, it also goes with the themes of the series as well. You know, in season one, it was about hope. You know, these were hopeful new cadets that were very hopeful that they, you know, their skills would carry them into Beacon. And again, the whole, and you know, learning to be teammates and things like that. Overall, a hopeful tone. Season two was more about discovery. Discovery, you know, again, we're friends, and you know, there's this dark cloud looming on the horizon, and will we be able to defeat it? And by the end, I think there's an establishment of, you know, each foe being formidable against the other. And again, going back to booking. You know, I think I'm making the story to be more integral than it really is. I mean, at the end of the day, the story is simple. You know, the story is just a vehicle for the animation. Because like I said, the mainstay of this series is its animation. It tells a lot of its story through the animation. And there's some girl power moments in here, and there's other character-defining moments that are fun and enjoyable to watch. But again, it's part of that larger build-up for, again, we're getting to the action scene. And I think some people might think that's a snub. But again, that's, again, it's that build-up to the climax. To where the fight is going to happen. Because again, that is where the strength of this series lies. It knows that's where its strength lies, and it builds up to that. So I think it's done extremely well. It's the story is much more simpler than it seems. Again, it plays with a lot of thematics, characters' personalities, and how they connect with each other. Really dive in sort of their fairy tale influence as well. That makes it fun as well, along with the comedy. But again, they never get too integral, and they never get too I don't want to say deep, but they don't get too crazy with the plot. They keep the plot for the most part simple. And all the storylines that it's just thing that it has a lot of different story threads, But they all connect very well. They always, by the end of each season, they all connect back with each other. So you know, it's almost like it's there's, I don't know what it's called, but it's like the thing that has a lot of threads, and when you push it, and like the threads expand out, but then when you pull it apart again, they all connect and everything. It's kind of like that. So I thought the story overall is done very well, very simple, and again, it provides a great vehicle for the animation to play off of. So overall, Red vs. Blue has had two seasons. We know there's probably a third season coming next summer. Certainly, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking, because again, Monty Woom, I think, has a great ornate eye for action. And it's that action animation, I think, whether people know it or not, that's what people are coming for. And he has enough of a well understanding of good storytelling to understand to tell a simple story and allow that story to be a vehicle for his animation. And allows for that animation then to tell the rest of the story. I definitely think anybody that wants to look for something different, something unique, definitely thing to check out. This is not going to be a series, though, for everybody. Definitely, I mean, I think animation fans will enjoy this. I think people who want to see something different, somebody who's into fairy tales might enjoy this. But I think people who aren't really animation, I worry about its mass appeal to a larger audience only because, again, there's some points where, you know, again, as we talked about with backgrounds, it can be a bit amateuristic. So I worry about that. And again, that's not a knock against them. Again, it's that time thing. But, you know, again, with this very short episode lengths and everything, I want, you know, there's not, this works very well as a web series that is dedicated to people who get their entertainment off the internet. As something that could be on a cable or broadcast or TV series or whatever, not so well. But as a internet entertainment, as an internet series, it works very well. So overall, I give Ruby a 4 out of 5. Very solid, very good, and again, the action scenes alone are worth checking out by themselves, but you definitely owe it to yourself to watch both seasons. Because they, in total, not just for the action scenes, because they're all really good, and it's worth watching. So 4 out of 5 for me. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have any comments of any kind that you want to leave the show, or there's several ways to contact the show, one, you can leave me an email at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. That's absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can also leave us a comment on our Stitcher account, which I can tell you for a fact will be, with this episode, it will be fully updated. I'm finishing up the touches tonight. I have to input some numbers, including this, the past two episodes put on the network. I will be doing that tonight. And so that will be up probably sometime tomorrow, as this episode will be, as of this recording. So go to Stitcher.com, search for us, leave us a comment there. Definitely subscribe to our podcast if you use Stitcher. You can also find us on Facebook by going to Facebook.com, search for the Absolution Network. We're the one that has the symbol of the A and the N in the circle. Like us, leave us a comment there. And, of course, you can always leave a comment on the website itself, which I highly advise you do, because really that's the best way I can get comments. You can find that at www.an.132productions.com. While you're at the website, make sure you check out all the other 132 Productions content. That, of course, includes everything here on the Absolution Network. My CM Juice Wrestling Reviews podcast, my Intergalactic Graphic Review, Tom's Top 10, and, of course, Shintaku Kuro and his wrestling and anime videos, John Ramos and his Toku Apocalypse and Spider-Man Toku videos, along with other videos that he does, like on voice acting. the Anticast with Relic, the Otaku Momentum, among others. So definitely check that out. And of course, I have some other podcasts that are on some other 132 production content sites. This, of course, includes Comic Book Crazy, Hexcast, the only podcast dedicated to Terra, which is Black Rose, and Spectacular Webs, which you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132production.com. And, of course, my Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast that you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. You can find all that and more as part of 132 Productions. And, of course, while you're at any of the sites, make sure you check out all our friends on the sidebar of the site. This, of course, includes Michael Bailey in Views from Alone Box, along with From Crisis to Crisis, that he does with his good friend Jeffrey Taylor. Spidey Dude and the Clone Saga Chronicles, Seems It's Like You're in the Critical Hit podcast, and of course, Scott Gunner and the 22 Freaks Podcasting Network. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Next week, well, it's February, which, this year for a change, we're not doing Disney Month in February. Not that we did Disney Month in February last year, because, stuff happened, if you remember, for those who were there. Again, I don't want to go into it. I am dreading February, folks, because for the past 3 years, stuff has gone down in February. And I'm not looking forward to it happening again. There's always a virus or something that happens to my computer. I'm praying that nothing happens again. But anyways, if all things go right and nothing happens, next week we will hopefully be able to start our romantic month of February. Because, of course, February is the month of love. Which means all month long we will be focused on romantic titles. And what better way than to start with a title that has Lover in it? It's also a harem ecchi title that's never been brought over to America. Yes, we're not going to have any Americans, as we're going to be doing a subtitle to review. As ladies and gentlemen, we review Princess Lover. Yes, I get to fill my harem and ecchi acquirement, and it's right off the bat. I sometimes love my job, so until next time on Toonami Generation, find cover. It's gonna get too dangerous. Stay golden.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.